we believe that the critical habitat adds recognition of the importance of the areas, but not any significant new requirements for developers.
The Interior Department releases its critical habitat designation for polar bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 24th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Energy Authority eyes the Susitna River for a hydro project.
The dam is expected to create a 39-mile-long lake reservoir with a width of 2 miles.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The Department of Interior today released the areas designated as critical habitat for polar bears. It's a vast 187,000-mile designation along Alaska's northern coast. Rosa Meehan is the Alaska Division Chief for Marine Mammal Management for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Areas over the continental shelf that extend from the border between Alaska and Canada along the Beaufort coast and down the Chukchi into the Bering Sea, with the southern limit being just below St. Lawrence Island. There's a small strip of terrestrial area along the coast of the Beaufort Sea. It extends anywhere from 5 to 10 miles inland, and it represents the area where 95% of the known polar bear dens on land have occurred.
Meehan says because polar bears are managed under both the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, there are currently protections in place that impact industry. The new habitat designation will not, however, change or enhance that.
And so because of this base management, we don't think, or we believe, that the critical habitat adds recognition of the importance of the areas, but not any significant new requirements for developers.
Meehan acknowledges that sea ice loss is the major driver of the need for protections to help save polar bears, and that loss is due to a warming climate impacted by fossil fuel emissions. But she says the ESA is not an effective method for addressing greenhouse gas. The Interior Department used something called the 4D rule when they listed the bears in 2008. It exempts greenhouse gas emissions from being regulated under the ESA. Brendan Cummings is with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the environmental groups that sued to trigger the habitat designation. He says the designated habitat areas are very good, but he says addressing climate change is going to require all available regulatory tools.
For the federal agencies to just sort of duck and run, say, not our issue, make some other agency deal with it or make Congress deal with it, is abdicating their responsibility. If we're going to protect and recover the polar bear, we need to start addressing greenhouse gas emissions, and the Endangered Species Act is one way to do so. It's not the only way, not necessarily the most direct way, but it is one way, and until we have something better, we should be using it.
Fish and Wildlife's Meehan says her agency is focused on what they can do right now, working to minimize further adverse effects on polar bears so at least some will survive and hopefully, she says, repopulate areas that have habitat protections if measures to stop sea ice loss are effective. She says within a few decades, the only refuge for polar bears may be the Canadian archipelagos, where sea ice is stable. She acknowledges the current situation is grim.
It sounds terribly bleak, and the thing that is important to me and what helps me keep coming to work is that I truly believe that if we can do our best for bears, protect their habitat, and continue to underscore, look, this is a consequence of climate change, that we can help with the argument for the entities that do have the authorities and the scope to deal with the issue can truly be motivated to do that.
Brendan Cummings says species with critical habitat designations are twice as likely to increase in numbers. But he says for the designation to work, the Department of Interior and other federal agencies need to take the protection mandate seriously.
If they do that, I actually believe that we can save the polar bear in Alaska and reach a point where if we're doing what's necessary to save the polar bear, we're also doing what's necessary to prevent the worst impacts of global warming for the rest of us.
North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta released a statement today expressing concern that the designation could impact subsistence hunting and routine oil and gas development on the North Slope. Barrow and Koktovik are exempt from the critical habitat designation rules, as are five Air Force radar facilities, but Itta worries that the designation could still stop a new runway from being built in Koktovik. Another element of the lawsuit that will be heard in December is the ESA listing itself. D.C. Judge Emmett Sullivan wants more clarity from the Department of Interior as to how they decide what species get a threatened designation or the more protective endangered listing. Those documents are due to the court on December 23rd. Arguments about whether the bears should be listed as threatened, endangered, or not at all will be heard in February. Arguments on the 4D rule exempting greenhouse gases from ESA regulation will be heard in April. The Alaska Energy Authority announced today that they are supporting and recommending the lower Wautana Dam on the Susitna River instead of the Chakachamna project. The authority has been expected to come out with a decision for the past couple of weeks. From KTNA in Talkeetna, Sue Dio has more on the decision.
The Alaska Energy Authority has been studying two big hydro projects this year in order to get a handle on future rail belt energy. Wednesday morning, they announced that the Susitna Dam makes more sense than pursuing the Chakachamna project. Soon after the decision was released, Governor Sean Parnell's office released his statement in full support of the dam on the Susitna River. The legislature provided funding to AEA for the preliminary planning, design, permitting, and field work for the Susitna Dam, Chakachamna, Glacier Fork, and other hydro projects. The primary focus was on the Susitna and Chakachamna projects. The Chakachamna project is east of Lake Clark National Park near the Cook Inlet. The Susitna project, north of the Devil's Canyon and south of Denali Highway. AEA Acting Director Mike Harper says the goal was to identify the project that had the best chance of being built. The authority concluded that the Chakachamna project has greater environmental impact because the project would require a cross-basin water transfer. The Susitna project, they say, would produce 2 to 3 times more energy at a lower per-unit cost. The Susitna project supposedly has fewer licensing and permitting issues. The dam is expected to create a 39-mile-long lake reservoir with a width of 2 miles. In 2010, House Bill 306 directed the state to receive 50% of its electrical generation from renewable and alternative energy sources by 2025. The authority says the only way for this to happen is to build a large hydroelectric project in the Rail Belt region. The current Lower Wautana proposal is much smaller than the original idea that was studied in the 1980s, but the overall cost of the dam construction is in the billions of dollars. AEA has appropriated $10 million in state funds to start the planning and design of the hydro project. Speculation amongst fish and wildlife employees and others attending the Mat-Su Salmon Symposium last week was the project was more than 12 years away from being built due to the environmental process the project will have to endure. AEA is planning public workshops in February. Parnell announced he will propose legislation this next session that will allow AEA to pursue funding for the project. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Republicans in both the U.S. House and Senate are pledging to ban earmarks. That's not sitting well with Alaska's congressional delegation, which is vowing to fight for them. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, whether earmarks survive is in question.
Earmarks have become a favorite target as a symbol of Washington waste, but they account for less than 1% of federal spending. Professor James Thurber, director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University, says despite all the talk slamming earmarks, they're a relative drop in the bucket.
Earmarks really don't make much difference in reducing the deficit. It's more symbolic than real, and it's very popular. It's easy to stand up in front of a crowd and say, I'm against earmarks. Unless you're from a place like Alaska.
The Senate GOP voted last week to voluntarily ban earmarks. Not all Republicans are on board, like Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma and Alaskan Lisa Murkowski. Murkowski agrees that it's about PR rather than substance.
I think it is a mistake to suggest to the public that by taking this action, somehow or other, we are reducing the deficit. We are reducing spending. It is more of a messaging.
But earmarks' biggest PR debacle comes right from Alaska, projects denounced as bridges to nowhere. They were pushed by Congressman Don Young and then Senator Ted Stevens as important infrastructure upgrades. But when they fought the call from other members of Congress to instead spend the money on a Louisiana bridge damaged by Hurricane Katrina, the projects became poster children of wasteful earmarks. Even 5 years later, they're still invoked by Senator John McCain, who railed against them last week. McCain also cited the case of Kevin Ring, who worked for corrupt lobbyist Jack Abramoff and was busted for bribing public officials.
Waste, abuse, corruption. Mr. Ring was just convicted as a result of the hearings we had on the Indian Affairs Committee with Mr. Abramoff. You know what Mr. Abramoff was all about? Earmarks. Earmarks and corruption. And I know it's corruption because I've seen it with my own eyes. And it will go a long way towards restoring the confidence of the American people in what we do here. No more bridges to nowhere.
McCain says earmarks are by their very nature corrupting. He'd instead like to see Congress approve funding in a different way.
Authorize the projects. That's all you have to do. Instead, the appropriators have just put him in the middle of the night without hearings, without consideration, without consultation. Authorization and then appropriation. That's the way the Senate worked for nearly 200 years, and then over the past 20 years or so, that process has been dramatically eliminated, which is why, the way, we don't have any authorization bills ever come before the Senate.
The way it works now, projects may be authorized, but unless they're actually funded through the appropriations process, they're dead in the water. Senator Mark Begich says McCain's plan is all well and good in theory, but Congress isn't exactly moving at lightning speed to pass authorization bills.
If he's saying that it's an authorizing bill that actually will come to the floor and actually have a vote and not filibustered and messed around with in parliamentary procedure, okay. But if it's this old gamesmanship they're going to do, like they've been doing for the last 2 years, we're going to require you have 60 votes to proceed on it, forget it.
Begich says tighten the rules, don't ban earmarks outright. It's now required that members of Congress post online their earmark requests. Begich says go even further and follow his office's lead. Show the names of everyone knocking on the door asking for money.
So our disclosure levels are one of the highest in the Senate. And we think that's important. That's what I was hearing during the election. People want to know, who are these people asking for these things? Who, you know, are there some lobbyists that just roam in the halls and trolling for earmarks? And what we said is, first thing we're going to do is make sure it's all transparent. Second thing is that they're community-based requests and that they're predominantly for infrastructure investments.
Democrats are not banning earmarks at this point, despite calls to do so by a few Senate Ds. But American University professor James Thurber says this really is a culture change.
I think elections matter, and the 2010 election had a clear message from people on the right, the Tea Group movement people, that they didn't like earmarks and they wanted to stop earmarks, and so therefore there's been a significant shift by many people in the Republican Party to stop them.
Except, of course, in Alaska, where voters re-elected Congressman Young, an unabashed earmark supporter, and likely re-elected Lisa Murkowski, who sits on the Appropriations Committee and ran on a platform of bringing money home. Just how much success they'll have swimming upstream against their party leadership will play out over the next few months. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
On Friday, we'll look at the effects earmark reductions are having in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, food banks and social agencies feel the pinch at Thanksgiving.
Because our numbers are up about 20 to 25%, and a lot of that has to do with our economy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
An attempt to remove Angoon Mayor Albert Howard from office appears to have failed based on preliminary results reported last night. Initial returns from Tuesday's recall election show 50 people voting yes on recalling Howard and 78 people voting no. About 430 people live in Angoon, which is on Western Admiralty Island. The recall petition accused Howard of exceeding his authority as mayor by entering into a deal to develop hydropower projects on Ruth Lake and Scenery Lake in Thomas Bay. Angoon has been dealing with the company Cascade Creek LLC and maintaining federal permits to develop the hydro projects at Ruth and Scenery Lakes. The recall language said those permits cost as much as $3 million each, and that parts of the agreement Angoon struck with Cascade Creek could result in substantial financial obligations and liabilities for the length of the agreements, some 50 years. Earlier this year, the Angoon Council voted to freeze all action on the Thomas Bay projects and asked its attorney to try and void any contracts with Cascade Creek. The private company holds a preliminary permit for another hydroelectric project at Swan Lake in Thomas Bay. Cascade formerly held permits for Ruth and Scenery as well, but has instead been working under contract to help Angoon develop those sites. Reached before the polls closed on Tuesday, Howard said a city council resolution in 2008 authorized him to act in the city's best interests, and that action he took is in the best interest of Angoon.
All it is a source of revenue for our community and the community members so we can create jobs. I mean, Angoon's been at 80% unemployment for 3 years that we've been in place. The council has been doing a really good job at trying to figure out what we need to do to take the community into the future. And this is one step of many steps.
Howard said he was willing to step aside without an argument if the vote had not gone in his favor, but he also said he hoped if the recall failed that those opposed to the deals with Cascade Creek would let the city move forward without opposition. That's not likely, says Maxine Thompson, a former Angoon mayor. Earlier on Tuesday, she said she'll continue to advocate against Angoon's involvement in the Ruth Lake and Scenery Lake projects if the recall was unsuccessful.
We have to maintain our position and say we oppose it because he refuses to go through the proper procedures. And the proper procedures is to disclose everything.
The results of Tuesday's election are not finalized until question ballots are counted. The number of question ballots was not immediately available. The election is expected to be certified on Monday. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has sent a notice to the city of Angoon about an overdue progress report for the Scenery Lake hydroelectric project. Angoon holds a preliminary FERC permit to study the potential for hydropower at Scenery Lake, one of three waterways under consideration for development in Thomas Bay on the mainland north of Petersburg. Angoon is also the permit holder for Ruth Lake and received a notice of an overdue progress report on that project earlier this month. The federal permits require filing a report every 6 months, and Angoon's latest report on Scenery Creek was due October 1st. Failure to file the report can mean the cancellation of a permit. Angoon has 30 days to submit a filing to try and keep that permit. Angoon City Council voted earlier this year to freeze all action on the Thomas Bay projects. Angoon permit filing proposes the construction of a 120-foot-high dam on Scenery Lake, which is nearly 1,000 feet above sea level. Water siphoned from the lake would be dropped down to sea level and would power four turbines capable of generating up to 40 megawatts. Scenery Lake is the one project of the three in Thomas Bay that has fish that could be impacted by hydro development. Scenery Lake is also within a roadless area of the Tongass National Forest. Petersburg opposed Angoon's application for the Scenery Lake permit because of Angoon's decision to work with the private company, Cascade Creek, on the project. That company held the preliminary permit for Scenery Lake from 2006 to 2009. State Representative Kyle Johansson is vowing a return to the Republican caucus. The embattled Johansson told constituents in Ketchikan this week that he will be in the Republican-led majority caucus when the legislature convenes in January. He also says he's likely to be chairman or co-chairman of a committee. Johansson, the former House Majority Leader, and Representative Cherise Millett, a Republican from Anchorage, left the caucus after it reorganized earlier this month over concerns about the group's direction. But during a town hall meeting in Ketchikan this week, Johansson says it's been made clear that he should be in Juneau to represent the concerns of his district, not statewide issues. This comes after the Ketchikan Daily News called for his resignation in an editorial. Johansson plans to meet with House Speaker Mike Chenault in Anchorage next week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Southeast Alaska churches and groups are collecting and preparing food for their community Thanksgiving dinners. At the same time, they're gearing up for the season's food and toy drives. Organizers say the need is greater this year, and that's probably due to the weak economy. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Salvation Army puts together Juneau's big Thanksgiving meal. It's held at a downtown restaurant, and with help from many community members, includes smoked turkey, gravy, pies, and all the usual fixings.
This is a community dinner. It does not mean that a person has to be destitute to come to that dinner.
Salvation Army Captain Jack Smith oversees the annual meal.
Maybe they're by themselves. Maybe they're lonely. Maybe it's just a husband and wife. The kids are not there anymore. And they would just like a time of fellowship. And we don't care if they're rich or poor or whatever, that they have a need.
Whatever that need, more people have it this year. Smith expects last year's turnout, about 380, will grow by 50 to 100. So the meal, starting at 11 a.m. at Hangar on the Wharf, will have 50 turkeys, up 8 from the previous event. Smith says a lot of the need is from the unemployed.
A lot of people that would normally be working this time of year are not working. Families that have come into the community thinking that this was going to be just a wonderful place to be and instantly they were going to have high-paying jobs, only to find out that that hasn't existed since the pipeline days.
Ketchikan's Salvation Army is also seeing needs increase. Major James Halverson says its soup kitchen fed 700 people a month a year and a half ago. Now it's up to 900. Alcoholism, drug abuse, and other social problems are contributing factors, but he says it's clear the lower 48's economic downturn has made its way north.
In the first year or so, we didn't really see it, but now we're seeing it more. I think it's finally creeping up to Alaska and Ketchikan area, and the economy is kind of driving what is happening.
The community is responding. A recent drive brought in more than 7,000 pounds of food. That will help with the Salvation Army's annual Thanksgiving meal, held midday the day before the holiday. Other Ketchikan groups provide dinners on Thanksgiving Day. The Juneau-based Southeast Alaska Food Bank is another organization that hands out groceries. Manager Darren Adams says, like others in the region, his numbers are up.
Once upon a time, a busy Saturday would get 15 to 20 people, maybe 25 on a super busy Saturday. And now we're routinely seeing 50, 60, upwards of 80 people some weeks.
The food bank just brought in close to 14,000 pounds of groceries through a drive, and more will be needed. Adams says the economy is part of the problem, but he's heard it's about expenses as much as unemployment.
You know, the cost of goods and services has been going up, and wages have not gone up to compensate, so people are trying to make do with a little bit less.
Other organizations also report increased need as they assemble food boxes for the holidays. Maria Levishuk runs Juneau's Glory Hole Soup Kitchen and Shelter. She tries to include as much as possible in holiday packages.
It has a turkey, and some people want a ham, and mashed potato fixings, canned corn, and beans, and peas. And it has cranberry sauce, and rolls, and butter, gravy and a pie, you're trying to put some like fresh fruits in there and milk and just kind of make them nice.
The Thanksgiving season kicks off many groups' Christmas food and toy drives. Organizers say they expect a difficult year with increased demands and some donors unable to give. James Halverson of Ketchikan Salvation Army asks those who can donate to do so generously.
Just be aware of the fact that there is a need in our communities, not only in the Ketchikan, but all over the Southeast. And so as you go through the Christmas season, just remember those that are in need and support what you can and when you can.
Other Southeast groups plan community Thanksgiving dinner and food box distributions. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
In Anchorage, Beans Cafe is expecting a crowd for Thanksgiving dinner. The cafe serves hot meals every day all year for those in need, as well as providing a day shelter as a safe alternative to the streets. Special meals are served on Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. Executive Director Jim Crockett says it takes about 120 volunteers to staff the Thanksgiving dinner.
We're anticipating between 1,200 and 1,300 people to be served in a three-hour period. We like to say that every day at Beans Cafe is Thanksgiving. We love our place. We're proud of our place.
He says community generosity has helped stock the shelves for the holiday dinner, although more vegetables and ham would be welcome.
You know, we can always use more because our numbers are up, about 20 to 25%, and a lot of that has to do with our economy. Our composition of our clientele that we see is now about 30% people that we've seen in the past that might be classified as a street inebriate, and 70% people that either are what we call the working poor, people that work and don't have enough food in the refrigerator towards the middle of the month, people that come up from the lower 48 looking for jobs, and rural to urban migration, a lot of people coming from Bush, Alaska to seek economic opportunities in Anchorage.
Crockett says cafe operators are seeing more families with children than in the past, although they refer families to agencies better suited to serve their needs. He says food donations are always welcome at Beans, since they serve all year. The cafe is trying out some new ways to stretch resources.
It's really kind of crazy when you think about it, but we've done some pretty innovative things around here that have made us become more efficient and effective in our operation. We have kind of a situation that you go through a line and various things are put on the plate, and we now ask people if they want that. So a client choice, so we don't waste a valuable resource. And two, we've gone to portion control.
Crockett says Beans Cafe has all the volunteers it needs for Thanksgiving. Over at the Food Bank of Alaska, Mary Mike Adams says that most agencies the food bank serves are reporting a 20 to 30% increase in numbers using the food services. Mike Keppel at the Rescue Mission of Anchorage says about 300 people are expected to come to the free Thanksgiving dinner at the mission. Keppel says donations are always welcome and that the mission especially needs blankets. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. We won't be here tomorrow, but we'll be back on Friday, and we hope you'll join us. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.